Institute. Mr. Renner, so why do you think we really want war with Iraq?
Well, I'm not particularly convinced that the official reasons that the administration is giving us are holding a whole lot of water. I think there are a number of other motivations that ought to be looked at, and I think clearly continuing to play a dominant role in the Middle East is, I would think, a major motivation. And in that context, of course, the fact that the Middle East is the primary oil region of the world is something that just cannot simply be overlooked.
But it has the second largest deposit of oil?
At this point, in terms of proven reserves, where you know, geologists actually have gone out and figured out what's in the ground, Iraq at this point has the second largest resources right after Saudi Arabia. But I think what's also important to note here is that much of Iraqi territory has never been fully explored. And based on that fact alone, and you know, based on the fact that Iraq clearly isn't a region that you know, has enormous resources, there are estimates out there that suggest that the actual, you know, fully recoverable reserves of Iraq could be substantially larger than what is assumed right now, and might actually be of an order that rivals those in Saudi Arabia.
And so has the U.S. Engaged in destabilizing that area and hegemony in that area, supporting one country over more than the others?
Well, I think the key really has been that the United States has been very eager to maintain a strong level of control over what happens in the region politically. So as long as governments are in power that are you know, pro-U.S. in their orientation, I guess the United States has no problem with stability. The problem, I think, has come in at various points in time when those regimes were overthrown or when there was, you know, other reason to think that maybe the established order was not going to hold up. That, of course, was particularly the case once the Shah of Iran was overthrown in 1979. This, of course, in a sense, led to instability in the region. But it's quite interesting to note that the preference in Washington at the time was to support the regime of Saddam Hussein when it decided to invade Iran. In other words, one could argue that the United States was not terribly interested in stability at that point because it did not serve U.S. interests.
But, well, and well, he was a monarchy that had been that had come to power through a military coup, right? There wasn't a democracy there. We weren't supporting a democracy.
Oh no, absolutely not. I mean, that I don't think that in the Middle East is ever much the question. Clearly, the regime that was put in place in Iran, as you say, was a monarchy, was a dictatorship, and it was put in place with very active U.S. support. There's no question about that. Virtually all of the other regimes in the region are most certainly not democracies by any stretch of the imagination. They may not have the same extremely bad human rights record as Iraq has certainly had, but there is no notion of a real democracy in the region.
Right, your article describes the Reagan administration and that he was an ally to the Reagan administration. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, he was a useful ally to the Reagan administration because Iran had fallen to the Islamic Revolution, so to speak. And there was, of course, at the time, a scramble in official Washington circles to find ways to counter the new regime in Tehran, to, in effect, make life for the Islamic revolutionaries hard. The only tool, in effect, that the United States had was to rely on Saddam Hussein, who, for his own reasons, made a calculation that Iran was in revolutionary disarray, could therefore easily be invaded and be forced to make certain concessions. That, of course, backfired in a very big time, and Iran at some point was very much looking like it would actually win the war with Iraq. This is the time when the Reagan administration decided to give major support to Iraq, support in the form of credits, of critical military intelligence, of basically allowing others to go ahead and supply arms to Iraq, providing also materials that were needed for the manufacture of chemical and biological weapons. So it was a big-time support for what at this time clearly was the international aggressor.
And none of this was to instill democracy in the area, though. We weren't supporting this him to encourage democracy.
Oh, I think that is quite obvious. I mean, democracy seems to feature quite large in official speech making, but in actual policy, I think it has a very low value.
It was obviously for oil.
I think oil is certainly one big factor, but I think another argument can be made that maintaining a Middle East with friendly regimes is also something that, of course, is favors Israel in the region. So I think the combination of that motivation and the desire to maintain an uninhibited flow of oil, I think, by and large, explain what U.S. oil policies have been all about.
So we didn't directly supply them with weapons, though, but we facilitated weapon sales to them?
Well, there was one particular instance where a front company of the CIA actually did go ahead and supplied cluster bombs to Iraq via a Chile-based front company. Other than that, it was more an indirect sort of a giving of a green light to others that were interested in supplying Iraq, and actually were interested in supplying both sides, Iran and Iraq, at the time.
And made a lot of money doing it.
Of course, made a lot of money doing that. Yes, it was a extremely profitable business for anybody who was eager and willing to supply.
So what does the U.S. Stand to gain, besides the obvious reasons of gaining control over Iraq? There's other countries that want that oil also, including France and China.
Well, there are two different levels, I think, that we need to look at. One is sort of a general sense of securing the flow of oil for coming years and decades, and having a strong hand over that flow of oil. I think that does give the United States quite a lever over other countries. There is, however, another level, and that concerns more what the particular corporate interests may be. And I think it's quite interesting that since the nationalizations that took place pretty much throughout the Middle East in the early 1970s, so in the last 30 years, U.S. companies really have not had direct access to Iraqi oil. It seems right now in this particular era that we're in, I mean, post 9/11, there is now an opportunity for the Bush administration to use the fear and anger that has arisen after 9/11 and turn that in such a way that it can argue the Iraqi regime has to be overthrown, and therefore the argument vis-a-vis France and Russia and China has been, if you do not go along with our policy, we cannot guarantee that you will have any access to Iraqi oil after the regime changes. So presumably, any serious opposition to giving a green light to the United States would mean that U.S. and presumably British companies will get first draw on Iraqi oil.
Well, so this could be used as in a way to blackmail isn't the right word, but I mean to encourage other countries to make decisions favorable to the U.S. We could use the oil.
I would think so, and I think we also have to look back to the first Gulf War in 1991, where a number of observers have argued strongly that countries that were on the UN Security Council at the time and who therefore had to, in effect, vote in favor of the war at that time, felt a lot of pressure put upon them by the United States in the sense of, if you don't vote for us, we will vote against credits going to you, we will make your life hard otherwise.
And so now we can use oil, we can hold back oil.
Well, oil, I think, is a different lever in this case because it's otherwise probably very hard to put a whole lot of pressure on a country like France or China or even Russia, for that matter. So the con- continued oil interests of companies from those countries and some others as well, are shaping up to be quite a lever that I think can induce those governments to pursue policies that they otherwise might not support quite in the same way.
Okay, so solutions. What do you think should be done?
Well, I think we really need to look at this from sort of a long-term perspective of, you know, most of what this is about is clearly relates to oil. What needs to happen to change this situation fundamentally is to get away from this oil addiction, clearly, that the United States, but also in a large sense the world economy has. I mean, this makes good sense for other reasons as well, of course. I mean, there is now growing evidence that for environmental reasons, it's a very bad idea to continue to consume lots of oil or lots of other fossil fuels. So, you know, the larger argument about what do we do about climate change, avoiding climate change, is in effect the same kind of question that we need to address. We need to move in the direction of alternative sources of energy, renewable sources that are less polluting. We need to do far better in terms of how efficiently we use energy. I mean, just think of, you know, the sports utility vehicles and other big cars that are more and more on the roads now. That really gets us in the wrong direction. So we need to go in the direction of more efficient cars, alternative means of transportation, promoting things like, you know, wind power, solar electricity. All in all, there really are a good range of alternatives that can be pursued, certainly far more than has been the case up to now.
Would you be in favor of a tax on oil? I remember back in the 70s, Senator Hayakawa wanted a $2.50 tax on oil, and we all thought he was crazy.
Well, I think in the end, yes. I mean, this would be one of the measures that would help us make that kind of a transition. Clearly, at this point, oil is unreasonably cheap. That may not be the way that people at a gasoline pump think. Obviously, we are all, most of the population in the U.S. is struggling right now with an economic crisis. But I think in the long run, if we can manage to gradually bring up the price of oil and other fossil fuels, and also use that money, use those revenues to make other sources of energy available. So in other words, to make it as smooth a transition as possible. And I think this is something that is doable, but we have to make a start as early as possible, because the longer it gets delayed, the harder this kind of transition gets, and the more we are condemned, in effect, to basically engage in resource wars.
And so there was an article by Jose Gonsalves of the Seattle Intelligencer, and he was saying that we need to get nuclear weapons away from Israel in that area too. What do you think of that?
Well, I think there's clearly a question of if we want to deal with weapons of mass destruction, if we want to deal with the underlying political instabilities in the Middle East, we have to get to a situation where no country in the region can possibly be allowed to have those kinds of weapons. Right now, of course, we are in a situation where the United States ensures that Israel can get away with having nuclear weapons. And that situation, is, as long as it continues, I think will ensure that other governments in the region, no matter what their political orientation is otherwise, will seek to have some kind of counter, will seek to have even nuclear weapons or some other kind of equivalent kind of weapon in their arsenal, simply to have the ability to deter Israel. That is something that any government, I think, takes as a given.
Right, and the other thing he mentions is the multinational corporations that supplied Saddam Hussein during the time that he was committing atrocities. Don't you think we should punish them first before we go bombing Iraq?
It certainly would make sense to take them to account and to say that this is not the kind of policy that is any longer being looked upon favorably. Of course, the problem is that at the time when this happened in the 1980s, primarily, not only was this something that various corporations were happy to do, but governments in many countries, not only in the United States, had no problem whatsoever with that. I mean, when you look at governments here, but also in Europe, many of them were quite happy to support the regime of Saddam Hussein at the time, because he seemed to be an ally. And as long as he was an ally, it did not matter a whole lot what he did.
An ally, even though he's a dictator. All right.
I think there's a long history, of course, of the United States in particular being quite closely allied with dictatorial regimes, as long as those regimes did the bidding of the United States. I think that's what it comes down to in the end.
Well, in the multinational corporations.
Yes, although I would think that, you know, at times it may well be possible that particular corporations may have different kinds of interests than are being pursued by the government at the time. I'm not sure that it's necessarily always a question of government and corporate interests being, you know, 100% aligned. But clearly we have seen in many cases that there were similar interests being pursued both in government offices and in the corporate world.
Mm-hmm. All right, anything on Colin Powell's speech today?
Well, I think Colin Powell's speech is, you know, obviously gets us much, much closer to a situation where it seems war is harder and harder to avoid. And I think the way the speech was delivered, I think, was quite deliberate in that sense. I would think that, I would hope, actually, that observers will ask some very serious questions. To the extent that what was presented as evidence during the speech is something that holds up. I think a very big question is, why was this kind of evidence withheld from the UN inspectors until now? Why are they not being given better evidence, more cooperation? Why are they, in effect, being set up to fail? That I think, is a question that really needs to be asked.
All right, and okay, so what is it exactly that you do for World Watch Institute?
Well, I'm a full-time researcher for them. And I, you know, primarily deal with issues of you know, peace and security in general, but also linking up those kinds of concerns with environmental issues. I mean, there's been a whole, you know, sort of category of discussion about environmental security, environment in conflict, and you know, this is something that has occupied me for a good number of years now.
Well, what do you mean? You mean what happens to the environment during war?
Well, that's one aspect, but it also actually works the other way around very often. In other words, that both environmental degradation on one hand, but also resource wealth can very often be strong factors that either trigger conflicts or aggravate them.
All right, Michael Renner of World Watch Institute, thank you very much for your time.
All right, well, it was a pleasure.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, you're welcome.
All right, bye.
Bye.
We like war. We are warlike people. We like war. We're a warlike people. We like war because we're good at it. You know why we're good at it? Because we get a lot of practice. This country's only 200 years old, and already we've had 10 major wars. We average a major war every 20 years in this country, so we're good at it. And it's a good thing we are. We're not very good at anything else anymore. Huh? Can't build a decent car, can't make a TV set or a VCR worth a fuck. Got no steel industry left, can't educate our young people, can't get health care to our old people, but we can bomb the shit out of your country, all right. Huh? We can bomb the shit out of your country, all right. Especially if your country is full of brown people. Oh, we like that, don't we? That's our hobby. That's our new job in the world, bombing brown people. Iraq, Panama, Grenada, Libya, you got some brown people in your country. Tell them to watch the fuck out, or we'll goddamn... Well, when's the last white people you can remember that we bombed? Can you remember the last white... Can you remember any white people we've ever bombed? The Germans, those are the only ones, and that's only because they were trying to cut in on our action. They wanted to dominate the world. Bullshit, that's our fucking job. Now we only bomb brown people. Not because they're trying to cut in on our action, just because they're brown. Now you probably noticed I don't feel about that war the way we were told we were supposed to feel about that war, the way we were ordered and instructed by the United States government to feel about that war. You see, I tell you, my mind doesn't work that way. I got this real moron thing I do, it's called thinking. And I'm not a very good American because I like to form my own opinions. I don't just roll over when I'm told to. Sad to say, most Americans just roll over on command. Not me. I have certain rules I live by. My first rule, I don't believe anything the government tells me. Nothing. And I don't take very seriously the media or the press in this country, who in the case of the Persian Gulf War were nothing more than unpaid employees of the Department of Defense, and who most of the time function as kind of an unofficial public relations agency for the United States government. So I don't listen to them, I don't really believe in my country, and I gotta tell you folks, I don't get all choked up about yellow ribbons and American flags. I consider them to be symbols, and I leave symbols to the symbol-minded. Me, I look at war a little bit differently. To me, war is a lot of prick-waving, okay? Simple thing, that's all it is. War is a whole lot of men standing out in a field waving their pricks at one another. Men are insecure about the size of their dicks, and so they have to kill one another over the idea. That's what all that asshole jock bullshit is all about. That's what all that adolescent, macho, male posturing and strutting in bars and locker rooms is all about. It's called dick fear. Men are terrified that their pricks are inadequate, and so they have to compete with one another to feel better about themselves. And since war is the ultimate competition, basically men are killing each other in order to improve their self-esteem. You don't have to be a historian or a political scientist to see the bigger dick foreign policy theory at work. It sounds like this. What? They have bigger dicks? Bomb them! And of course, the bombs and the rockets and the bullets are all shaped like dicks. It's a subconscious need to project the penis into other people's affairs. It's called fucking with people. So, as far as I'm concerned, that whole thing in the Persian Gulf was nothing more than a big prick-waving dick fight. In this particular case, Saddam Hussein had questioned the size of George Bush's dick.
And George Bush has been called a wimp for so long. Wimp rhymes with limp. George has been called a wimp for so long that he has to act out his manhood fantasies by sending other people's children to die. Even the name Bush. Even the name Bush is related to the genitals without being the genitals. A Bush is a sort of passive secondary sex characteristic. Now, if this man's name had been George Boner, well, he might have felt a little bit better about himself and we wouldn't have had any trouble over there in the first place. This whole country has a manhood problem. Big manhood problem in the USA. You can tell from the language we use. Language always gives you away. What did we do wrong in Vietnam? We pulled out. Not a very manly thing to do, is it? When you're fucking people, you gotta stay in there and fuck them good. Fuck them all the way. Fuck them till the end. Fuck them to death. Fuck them to death. Fuck them to death. Stay in there and keep fucking them until they're all dead. We left a few women and children alive in Vietnam, and we haven't felt good about ourselves since. That's why in the Persian Gulf, George Bush had to say, "This will not be another Vietnam." He actually used these words. He said, "This time we're going all the way." Imagine an American president using the sexual slang of a 13-year-old to describe his foreign policy. If you want to know what happened in the Persian Gulf, just remember the names of the two men who were running that war, Dick Cheney and Colin Powell. Somebody got fucked in the ass. Thank you. Thank you very much. Well, tell you what. Now, to balance the scale, I'd like to talk about some things that bring us together. Things that point out our similarities instead of our differences. Because that's all you ever hear about in this country is our differences. That's all the media and the politicians are ever talking about, the things that separate us, things that make us different from one another. That's the way the ruling class operates in any society. They try to divide the rest of the people. They keep the lower and the middle classes fighting with each other so that they, the rich, can run off with all the fucking money. Fairly simple thing happens to work. You know, anything different, that's what they're going to talk about. Race, religion, ethnic and national background, jobs, income, education, social status, sexuality, anything they can do, keep us fighting with each other so that they can keep going to the bank. You know how I describe the economic and social classes in this country? The upper class keeps all of the money, pays none of the taxes. The middle class pays all of the taxes, does all of the work. The poor are there just to scare the shit out of the middle class. Keep them showing up at those jobs. So stirring up the shit is something I like to do from time to time, but I also like to know that I can come back to these little things we have in common, little universal moments that we share separately, the things that make us the same. They're so small we hardly ever talk about them. Did you ever look at your watch and then you don't know what time it is? And you have to look again, and you still don't know the time. So you look a third time, and somebody says, "What time is it?" You say, "I don't know." Do you ever notice how sometimes all day Wednesday, you keep thinking it's Thursday? And it happens over and over all day long. And then the next day, you're all right again. Do you ever find yourself standing in one of the rooms in your house and you can't remember why you went in there? And two words float across your mind: Alzheimer's disease. You ever been talking to yourself and somebody comes in the room and you have to make believe you were singing? And you hope to God the other person really believes there's a song called "What Does She Think I Am? Some Kind of Putz?" Somehow I can't feel sorry for an anorexic, you know? Rich cunt, don't want to eat? Fuck her. Don't eat. I give a shit. Like I'm supposed to be concerned about this. I don't want to eat! Go fuck yourself. Why don't you lie down in front of a railroad train right after you don't eat? What kind of a goddamn disease is that anyway? I don't want to eat! How do we come up with this shit in this country? Where do we get our values from? Bulimia, there's another all-American disease. This has got to be the only country in the world that could ever have come up with bulimia. Got to be the only country where some people are digging in the dumpster for a peach pit, other people eat a nice meal and puke it up intentionally. Where do we get our values from? I do not understand our values. By the way, speaking of American values, aren't we about due to start bombing some small country that only has a marginally effective air force? Seems to me like we're weeks overdue to drop high explosives on helpless civilians. People who have no argument with us whatsoever. I think we ought to be out there doing what we do best, gang, making large holes in other people's countries. I hate to be repetitious, but we are a warlike lot. We can't stand it not to be fucking with somebody. We couldn't wait for that Cold War to be over, could we? Couldn't wait for the Cold War to be over so we can go and play with our toys in the sand. Go and play with our toys in the sand. And when we're not invading some sovereign nation or setting it on fire from the air, which is more fun for our Nintendo pilots, then we're usually declaring war on something here at home. Did you ever notice that about us? We love to declare war on things here in America. Anything we don't like about ourselves, we declare war on it. We don't do anything about it. We just declare war on it. It's the only metaphor we have in our public discourse for solving problems, declaring war. We have to declare a war on everything. We have a war on crime, the war on poverty, the war on litter, the war on cancer, the war on drugs. But you ever notice we got no war on homelessness, huh? No war on homelessness. You know why? There's no money in that problem. No money to be made off of the homeless.
QRadio.org. Of course, that was George Carlin, and before that was Michael Renner of the World Watch Institute. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends. Thank you. KillRadio.org. Of course, that was Stu Hamm.
It's the one and only Stuart Hamm on bass guitar.
Oh.